Before we actually start the class this evening, brethren and sisters, Brother John has a few remarks.
Now, it's not going to be a policy speech, there's nothing about Bible marking or anything like that. Before we actually get onto the study of Daniel this evening, I thought we'd spend perhaps about 10 minutes having a look at some of the translations which we've been referring to in our notes. Now, I know that some people wonder how and why it is that we just keep periodically pulling out of the air other translations of the Bible. I know particularly some of the young people do this, and I thought it wouldn't be a bad idea if I just made one or two comments on what some of these translations are and why it is that under some circumstances we prefer to go to other translations, and how, for that matter, we determine on what particular translation we're going to go to. Now, I think you might find this of good general interest and also help you to understand why occasionally we've got R, V, R, S, V and all sorts of other things in these coloured notes. Now, I think we're all fairly familiar with the Bible which we generally use, which we call the Authorised Version. It's called the Authorised Version because it's authorised to be read in churches, and that's why it's called the Authorised Version. It was around about 1611 that this particular translation was done. And by and large, it's quite a good sort of translation. The English is getting a little bit old-fashioned, and probably one of the greatest drawbacks to it is the fact that the translators have not been consistent in the way in which they've translated certain Hebrew and Greek words. They've had sort of whims and fancies, and they'll translate a word hell in one place and grave in another place, and things like this. So this is the biggest drawback with the Authorised Version. Probably the main reason we stick with the Authorised Version is that most of the concordances and that sort of thing are keyed to this one, so that Young's Concordance and Strong's Concordance relate to the words in the Authorised Version. So for study purposes, most of the books are related to it, therefore we still stick with the Authorised Version. It's not a bad translation, but it does have certain inadequacies, and these have been made up by other translations. Now, I don't think there's any one translation that is by any means perfect, but they all have their good features. And I want to try and indicate some of these features so you'll see why we go to these from time to time. Basically, the next main translation that came on the scene was the revised version of about 1870, 1880. I forget what date it is because someone borrowed mine and I can't find it. But it's around about 1870 to 1880. Now, Arnold down there has a translation of the Bible, which is known as the Interlinear Translation, which has the Authorised Version and the Revised Version in the same text. So that where the words are the same, you just have one word, and where the text differs, it puts the Authorised Version in the top line or bottom line. Oh, yours has got it in the columns. Well, he's got the two versions there, but there is one called the Interlinear, revised on the top and authorised on the bottom. Be that as it may, though, the Interlinear version has both the revised and the authorised. So we've got what we'll abbreviate as the AV. That's the one we always work to. That's the 1611 King James version, if you like. Then you've got the RV, which is the 1881. Revised version. Now, a quick reading of the revised version doesn't appear to be very greatly different to the authorised, but I think one of the main features is that they have been a bit more consistent in their translations of words. It is considered by many people to be one of the best translations. It's fairly conservative. It doesn't lash out and sort of try to interpret words. By and large, it doesn't appear a lot different from the authorised, but it is just that much more consistent with its translation. Arnold, you'd be a bit more familiar with that one than I am. You use it a lot. Would you have any other observations on that?
Well, the strange thing about this is it's never been popular.
No.
And yet, I would say it is one of the best versions of the
original. Mainly its consistency, would you say, is probably...
They are pretty good.
Yes, and fairly conservative.
And they changed a lot of the old English words to modern English.
Yeah. But you can see that here it was done 1881. People were fairly conservative. It was the Victorian era. I don't know whether you had a Victorian era in America, did you? and that was, as I say, fairly conservative. So they're two good general translations. The next general sort of translation would be the RSV, which was about 1950, early 1950s, I think it would be, about 1954. I'll take a guess at 1954. And that is known as the Revised Standard Version. Now, the Revised Standard Version tended to become just a little bit more liberal in its translation, but I think it's a very good one for reading with children. It's not as free as some of the very modern translations, like the New English one, which sort of put in words that just aren't accurate. This one has become freer, but it's good for reading, I think, with children, because it just flows a little bit more smoothly. And it has that added advantage of what we were talking about Sunday morning, of distinguishing between the prose and the poetry. For example, if I just open on a page like that, you can see that's just ordinary writing. But when you flip open to the book of Job, you can see how it is set out differently. You can even pick out probably from a distance, but it's set out in verse form. Now, the advantage is when you come, say, to the prophets, you mightn't pick it on that page fairly clearly. There's an interesting page in Jeremiah chapter 10. Notice how it's ordinary prose down there, and then suddenly it becomes poetry. And it does distinguish between the prose and the poetry, and tries to give the idea of those parallels, of the parallelism we were talking about on Sunday, the rhyming of the meanings of the words. When it first came out, Christadelphians were somewhat critical of it because it wasn't as accurate as they would have liked, but it's not too bad. I've got a liking for it in some respects, particularly in the prophets. I think it tends to make them flow a bit more smoothly. So those are the three general versions, the authorised version, the revised version of 1881, a little bit more consistent, the revised standard version, just a little bit much more liberal, but it's quite a good version. I wouldn't consider that any of those three are what we would call the real study versions. They're good for general reading. But now when you want to get really analytical, probably you can't do any better than Rotherham's, the emphasised Bible. And we usually abbreviate that in our notes as ROB, and that's also known as the emphasised Bible. The emphasised Bible. Now this is very accurate. I just opened it on a page. I was going to try and pick out one that just sort of doesn't read too. The page I picked on it is fairly right. When a Bible tends to become very accurate, it becomes difficult to read. Now, I don't know whether you can see it here, but it's got all marks in the text, arrows and asterisks and little dashes and things like this. It's set out in a way which is hard to follow, and sometimes it's not smooth flowing, but it's extremely accurate. So if you want a version which is extremely accurate, sometimes it's not smooth flowing, because in order to try and translate from the Hebrew to the English, sometimes, you know, it's a bit difficult to get the correct idiom. Now therefore, lo, Yahweh hath suffered a spirit of falsehood to be put into the mouth of these thy prophets, but Yahweh hath spoken concerning thee, two lines, evil. Then drew near Zedekiah, son of Chenanah, and smote Micaiah upon the cheek, and said, which then is the way the Spirit of Yahweh passed from me to speak with thee? That's perhaps not much different from the authorised, but as you go down there, you find that it's a sort of a stilted language. But a very accurate one, and probably the best on the Old Testament anyway, as far as accuracy of words is concerned. There's only one that's a bit more stilted than that, and that's Young's literal translation. So this fellow who wrote the Concordance also... we put it down as Young's Lit, because if you see Young in the note, it probably means Young's Concordance. Now, Young's literal translation, he's been very literal. And Jehoshaphat lieth with his fathers, and is buried with his fathers in the city of David, and Jehoram his son reigneth in his stead. and he hath brethren, sons of Jehoshaphat, Azariah and Jehiel and so. And Jehoram riseth up over the kingdom of his father, and strengtheneth himself, and slayeth all his brethren with the sword, and also of the heads of Israel. Very, very stilted, because it's tried to get this, continuous present tense into it. The benefit of Young's is that he has been very, very consistent with his translation. If he translates the word one thing in one place, it's about the same everywhere else. He's tried very hard to be consistent, but I don't know that his meanings are always accurate. A bit like his concordance, it's a bit, you know, his definitions in his concordance are fairly vague, so that he's got a meaning that's about right, and that's about the same with his translation. He's got a meaning that's about right, but he uses it the same way all the way through. So that those, Rotherham and Young's, are very literal and not easy for smooth reading. Now the other extreme to that is Moffat, who has really gone for smooth flowing reading. He's quite exciting, but I think he becomes quite inaccurate at times. Because it suits him, he'll just take a chapter and he'll stick it somewhere else in the book, because he just feels that that's where it should be. He'll divide up chapters and put them all over the place. He really goes for the idea of poetry, so much so that, as we mentioned previously, he even tries to rhyme the translation in order to give us the impression of poetry. I do like his introduction to Ecclesiastes. A sayings of the speaker, David's son, king in Jerusalem. Utterly vain, utterly vain, everything is vain. Man labours at his toil under the sun, what does he gain? The generations come and go, but there the earth is, there shall it remain. See how he's rhymed vain, gain and remain, but he's had to just twist it a little bit to do it. The rising sun goes down, it hurries round, only to rise again. From south to north the wind blows round. The wind turns as it blows, turning and then returning on its tracks. The streams all flow into the sea, but the sea they never fill, though the streams are flowing still. All things are aweary, weary beyond words. The eye is never satisfied, the ear has never enough. And it's very exciting reading, particularly in the prophets. And I do think that without being too critical of him, he does bring the drama out in the prophets in a beautiful way. But I wouldn't like to quote him as saying, well, Moffat translates this word this way. I think you'd be really, you'd really be barking up the wrong tree. Certainly you'd go to Rotherham and say, Rotherham translates this word this way, and you'd be on a good wicket there. There'd be a fairly good chance of that one being right, but not with Moffat. So that's basically the majority of Old Testament translations. I didn't bring the New Testament ones along. Perhaps on another occasion we might comment on that. So when we refer to them then, our general ones are the Authorised, the Revised, and the Revised Standard. Rotherham and Young are extremely literal. We'll call them literal translations. And Moffat would be, I would call, a liberal translation, but exciting reading. So they've all got their part to play. And usually you'll find if anyone quotes Moffat, they quote a section out of Moffat.
Just to point on what the revised
1881
is when the New Testament was
written, and 1884. Yes, I knew there was a couple of dates in that, you know. Yeah.
John, it'd be true to say that the Authorised, the RV, the RSV, and Moffat were more particularly versions, whereas, say, Rotherham and Young's literary instances would be transliterations or translations as accurate as possibly the ancient text. Whereas the word version implies that it's a man or a group of men who are trying to interpret the text rather than make it a version rather than a translation. Is that the idea?
I don't know what to say to that, really. you sound as though you're talking with authority there, and I'm not. That sounds right.
He put his own thoughts in Christ as Ecclesiastes, and he's given his impressions of what the word means for him. And this was a version which only he has done, but the others, in particular, none of them, has translated the word literally, so it doesn't make all of your attention English.
Yeah, I agree with your comments there. Just whether the terms version and translation apply in that sense, I wouldn't like to say. But you see, they've all had a different aim. Moffat has wanted to make the Bible interesting and readable and exciting. So he says, I'll try and put it into English as near as I can to what I reckon is about the sense. Rotherham, on the other hand, has said, now, I want to give an exact translation of these words. And in so doing, there are things like Hebrew idiom and that sort of thing that it's a bit hard to convey. I said I wasn't going to mention the New Testament, but in the New Testament there are two very liberal translations. One is Weymouth, who is quite good but liberal. The other one is J.B. Phillips, which I don't like at all. He's also written a book called Letters to Young Churches. I suppose that helps to put us off too. But I can always remember the one where Paul says, it was Paul. When Elymas, the sorcerer, offers him the money, I think it was Elymas, offered him money to give him the gift of the Holy Spirit, and it says in the Authorised Version, my money perish with thee. Well, J.B. Phillips says, to hell with you and your money. No, well, you see, I suppose it does say, you've got the word perish there, you see. Well, perish might mean to confine to Hades or something like that. And he saw that there and that's what he says. I think that's just sort of going over the fence to make it sort of readable by a strange woman. Of course, you've got the New English Bible, which is, again, trying to be very readable and I think quite inaccurate in places. And then, of course, they've gone even crazier now with these Bible for Modern Man and things like that. I'm not interested in those because I don't see any good really coming out of them at all. But those are the main ones we're referring to in our study on Daniel. Have I used any others? Oh, yes, of course, this one. Yes, this one. This is the Septuagint version. Now, the Septuagint is written in a very intellectual form. The abbreviation for that is LXX, because in Roman, L stands for 50, and X stands for 10, and X stands for 10, and 50 plus 10 plus 10 equals 70. And in Latin, Septuaginta is the Latin word for 70, and therefore, if you take the A off the end, you've got Septuagint, which really means 70. Therefore, LXX means 70. Therefore, LXX is the abbreviation which you will find in the notes for the Septuagint version of the Bible, because it was translated by 70 men. And the 70 men did a translation which they called the Translation of the 70. Now, this particular one is different from all of the others, inasmuch as it is a Greek version of the Old Testament. It was done around about a couple of hundred years BC in the time of one of the Ptolemies. I think it was Ptolemy Philadelphus down in Egypt. And he got 70 Hebrew scholars to prepare an Old Testament in Greek. So this version is a version taken out of the Hebrew into the Greek. And you'll find the Greek text is in most of these. There's your Greek text down there, like your diaglot, with your English translation. Now, where this one is interesting is because quite often in the New Testament writers, in quoting from the Old, quote from this version, because it was the Greek version which was commonly in use in many parts of the world in the time when the New Testament writers wrote. So it's I haven't got any real observations on the accuracy of it. I feel that sometimes, you know, going from one language to another, you're sort of increasing the problems and the chances of error. Like the Latin, like the Catholic Douay version, came from the Hebrew, I think, into the Greek, from the Greek to the Latin Vulgate, from the Vulgate into the French, and then from the French into the English, which means you've got a lot of chance of error creeping in. So that this one does introduce an extra language, Hebrew to Greek, and then Greek to English. And I think it's just an interesting one, and I haven't got any observations as to whether it's accurate, inaccurate or not. I think it's just sometimes I think it's not terribly accurate. But as the New Testament writers sometimes use it, not always, but sometimes, we should be aware of that one. Any thoughts or questions arising out of that?
That 70, John, was a student banks over the next few years because it was written in 70 days. So it's actually written over a period of about 200 years, and if you look at the Septuagint carefully, you'll find it's never been completed. It's quite a bit left out of it. It never has been completed.
What sections did
I can't just offhand, but anyway.
I know it ends with Malachi, that was all.
Now, sections have been put in there since.
Have they?
They were never completed originally at
all. Oh, I hadn't heard of that, so there's another observation on it. But I wouldn't place any great credence on it myself, but it could be all right and it might not be. It's just one of those translations. You don't know what to make of it. But it's there, and you'll come across it, so...
I think it's
there.
When you're reading the New
Testament,
you often
come across the verse 110. Yes. And the words following that are completely confusing. Mm. And something to the, go back to the Old Testament usage of it, inhabitant,
and look up
at that during the
series.
Yes. It
seems rather exactly what you're saying.
One of the reasons I brought this in too tonight is because in this section we're dealing with in Daniel tonight, we come to the period of the 2,300 days. Now, Brother Thomas, and I'm very loath to disagree with Brother Thomas on anything, as you will know, takes the Septuagint version translation of that for some reason. Probably because this is what he wanted to believe, and in there it's got 2,400 days. To my knowledge, it's the only translation that gives that, and Brother Thomas accepts the 2,400 as being more correct than the 2,300. And I believe thereby does not come up with the correct time period, as we'll have a look at in a moment. But this is an observation which you'll find in the Exposition of Daniel, and also if you've got the older versions of Elpis Israel, he has it in the back of Chronicon Hebraicon. On the bottom of page 28 of Exposition of Daniel, he says, I have, for reason given in Chronicon Hebraicon, adopted the reading of 2,400 instead of 2,300. And he takes it from the Septuagint version. Well, perhaps with that little bit of a preamble, we can go on then. Take over.
Glad to introduce the study, Brother Jeff Johnson, to read for us in the Authorised Version, Daniel chapter 8, verse 13 to 27.
Reading together, Daniel chapter 8, verses 13 to 27. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint put unto that certain saint and spake, how long shall be the vision concerning a daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, after 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And it came to pass, when I, even I Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me at the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Euphrates, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood. And when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground. But he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia. And the great horn, that is between his eyes, is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper, and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he will cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted, and was sick certain days. Afterward I rose up, and did the king's business. And I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it.
Right, now we're going to proceed on with our study of Daniel chapter 8. Cast your minds back, though, to what we said earlier in the year. We mentioned that the first six chapters were going to be fairly plain sailing, didn't we? And I think some got a little overconfident, and now when they've come to chapters 7 and 8, they've found it fairly hard going. I know this. I've had a little bit of feedback on this. And I think the thing that's causing the hard going here is basically the history, the background history. So in order to try and help out with this, we've had these maps run off, which may help somewhat in your understanding of this, the historical section of Daniel chapter 8. Now, I think we've all got a fairly clear picture of the fact that when the Babylonian Empire fell, the Medes and Persians took over. When the Medes and Persians fell, the Grecians took over, first of all, in the form of Alexander the Great. We've got this, haven't we, in chapter 8, verse 8. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and he was strong. And this he-goat had a great horn. This great horn was Alexander the Great. Now, from here on, probably, you get a little bit hazy on what happened to history. You don't know quite how we got from the brazen belly through the brazen thighs, the two thighs, down into the iron legs and thence into the feet. Well, these maps may help a little bit. The first map, that is on the sheet which has got three maps on it, the one at the top of the sheet there is called the breakup of the Empire of Alexander at the close of the 4th century BC. How many haven't got these sheets? Oh, right. Can we fix that, Gordon, please? Oh, they're going up there. Good, eh? Now, if you look very carefully at this map, you'll see that there are actually four sections which have been enclosed with these dashed lines. The one at the top is the Empire of Lysimachus, and you see it covers the area of Thrace and Bithynia. Then to the left of that, you've got the Empire of Cassander, which is the area of Macedonia and Greece proper. Coming down to the south, incorporating Egypt and Palestine, is the Empire of Ptolemy, and then extending right over into through Turkey into Babylon, and thence over into Persia and over to the borders of India, you've got the Empire of Seleucus. So you see, this is covered in both Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 8, when it says that after the great horn was broken, there came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. So as a horn represents this king, or this powerful man, so the great horn was broken, and these four horns appeared in the kingdom of men. So that map, I thought, shows it very clearly. Now the next map, as it rightly says, is a further stage in the breakup of Alexander's empire in the first half of the 3rd century BC. Now notice what has happened. The empire of Lysimachus and the empire of Cassander have disappeared. And we now have only two kingdoms, the Seleucidan Empire to the north of Israel and the Ptolemaic Empire to the south of Israel. Now I think we're all well aware of the fact that in Daniel chapter 11 we have a very detailed description of the battles between what is styled the King of the North and the King of the South. Now that is the King of the North and the King of the South. Seleucus, or his empire became known as the Seleucidan Empire, was the King of the North because he was to the north of the Promised Land, and the Ptolemies, they were to the south. And you'll hear plenty about them when we come to Daniel 11. So that's how we went from one horn to four horns, and how those four horns ultimately resolved themselves into two kings, the kings of the north and of the south. And this is around about 300 years before Christ. Now, we're not going to go into a lot of detail as to how these empires ultimately became Roman. But the Roman power ultimately infiltrated into this area, and it wasn't through any particular battles or conquests or anything like that, but Rome just ultimately absorbed Greece, and Greece merged into Rome, and the Romans held sway, and Greek culture was still very powerful, so that it became a sort of a Greco-Roman empire, as Brother Thomas would style it. Well then, I think we're all fairly well aware at the time of Christ that the Roman Empire went right around through the land of Israel. And you had your various Caesars and men like that reigning. Probably the greatest time of the empire was the time of what was known as the Julio-Claudian emperors. That was the Emperor Augustus, who was reigning at the birth of Christ. Tiberius, who was reigning at the death of Christ. Claudius, Caligula, and Nero. They were the five emperors that went from sort of the year BC AD naught, you know, that year, through to about roughly AD 70, about AD 68. And that period was the period of the five Julio-Claudian emperors. And the Julian was their family name. They all had about five or six names, you know, Augustus, Tiberius, Claudius, Nero, Germanicus, someone or other. And they might have called him Claudius for short. You'll find that if you look at their full names, you wouldn't know which one it was, because they all had a Claudius, a Julius, a Nero. They all had those in. They usually threw a Germanicus in too, but one of them they called Nero, another one they called Claudius, another one they called Augustus, and this sort of thing. So around about that time, Rome was at its most powerful. From then on, AD 70 onwards, Rome started to deteriorate through internal corruption. And if you have a look now at the next map, AD 50, we could have put a few more in, but I didn't think it was worth it. You'll see how up in Europe there was the Empire of the Huns. Now, by this stage, the empire had divided itself into two sections. There was the Western Roman Empire and there was the Eastern Roman Empire. Two quite distinct divisions. Now this, of course, answers to the two legs of the image there. And it also answers to the difference between Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 8. Because Daniel chapter 7 traces out the history of the Western Roman Empire, whereas Daniel chapter 8 traces out the history of the Eastern Roman Empire. Now that is the difference between the two chapters. Naturally, the two chapters sort of start off the same. You go through Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. But from then on, they diverge. And chapter 7 looks at the Western section, chapter 8 looks at the Eastern. Just a quick revision. What happened to the Western Empire? Well, if you want to cheat, turn over to the next sheet, and you'll see that the map AD 476 will help to explain this, because by this year, the Western Roman Empire has now disappeared. It's disappeared because it's been invaded by all these tribes out of the north. And you'll see some of them there, the Franks and the Burgundians and the Gepidae, the Lombards. These are some of the names that we've read about, the various tribes which invaded Rome. And ultimately, at least in AD 476 anyway, the Vandals were in charge of Italy. The Vandal kingdom was the kingdom of Italy. It changed a bit from time to time. Different other powers invaded it. But the Western Roman Empire itself had disappeared. By AD 771, you'll notice on our next map that even the Eastern Roman Empire had sort of disappeared, and it was now called the Byzantine, or the Byzantine Empire, however you like to pronounce it. Now, we could, of course, produce further maps and show how that the Western Kingdom was sort of re-established later on as the Holy Roman Empire by Charlemagne, when he came down and when he was made emperor. Now, let's just have a closer look at this AD 771 map. Can you pick out Italy there? Well, now, let's take a sort of a good guess here. Can you see the word papal state? Put it this way, Italy is actually in white and the sea is dark. This might be the reverse of what you're used to looking at, but if you follow the white area, you'll actually see the shape of Italy there. And it looks something like this. Which way does the toe go, down or up? Goes down. That way. Right, there's Italy. You can see two lines going across there. You can see two lines looking like this. See two lines like that and an arrow saying papal state. Now it's interesting because that condition of the southern states of Italy and the northern states of Italy with the papal states in the middle continued right through till last century. And it was only when the Pope lost his temporal power in 1870 that those papal states were lost. See, temporal power means that he's got actual country, for the actual land that he rules over. This was his temporal power that he had here. So you've got the kingdom of Lombardy and then in the north here, the kingdom of Piedmont and Lombardy, that's right, in the north, and the kingdom of the two Sicilies in the south. So you've got your southern Italians and your northern Italians, and the papal states in the middle. And you notice that that was there even in AD 771. It was there as early as that. And of course, Charlemagne then took the western section of the Roman Empire and he made it the Holy Roman Empire. And that lasted for hundreds and hundreds of years. So that, as we mentioned last class, even in the days of the First World War, there were, I think we decided, two emperors and two Caesars, four Caesars and one emperor reigning in Europe. This was the result of the work which Charlemagne had done in setting up this Roman Empire again in Europe, as he saw it. Well then, coming now to the eastern section, we're looking at this area which ultimately became the Byzantine Empire. And this was concentrated in the area of Constantinople. So that the western section became preeminently a religious one, the one from where the popes ruled, and Constantinople became more the militaristic aspect. So that looking down to the present day, we are going to find that the Roman Empire will re-establish itself again when Russia takes Constantinople and makes the coalition with the Pope. You'll have the ancient Western and Eastern Roman Empires appearing again. I'm not saying they're going to appear under that name, but they will appear under those principles, and that Russia will be the latter-day King of the North, and the Pope, of course, will be the ruler in the western section of the Roman Empire. So we want to have a look then at Daniel chapter 8 and see how he tells us a bit about this and how he brings us down to the latter day manifestation of this power in Constantinople. Now we take up the theme from about verse 13. I don't think I gave you any notes on verses 11 and 12 last time, but they'll be coming out tonight, but I did make a few comments on those. Now, when we come to verse 13, we've got the question which is asked, how long shall be the vision? Now, we're told here that then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision? And when you look at the margin there, you've got a somewhat confusing comment which says, or the number of secrets, or the wonderful number, and then they have another go at it again and they say Hebrew, Palmoni. Well, what you've actually got here is two saints, or two angels. Daniel sees this in vision, where two holy ones are having a conversation. It presents it in rather an interesting light. It shows the way in which the angels oversee the affairs of the kingdom of men. Here in this vision, it's depicting two of them as though they were discussing this matter and discussing how long it was going to be. So you find that there was one saint here, this was of course an angel, speaking unto another saint. Now wait a minute, then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint. So the first saint that was speaking is the same as this third one, which is called that certain saint, all right? I heard a saint speaking, then another saint said unto that certain saint, how long shall be the vision? So the term that certain saint, we're told here in the Hebrew, means, is the Hebrew word palmoni, and it means the numberer. This is interesting because it is presenting us with a picture here of this certain angel who has the oversight of these particular events. So that even as Michael, the archangel Michael, would appear to have the oversight of the affairs of Israel, the archangel Gabriel was particularly associated with the work of the Lord Jesus Christ. He appears to Daniel and gives him the vision of the 70 weeks prophecy. And then 490 years later, or thereabouts, he appears to the father of John the Baptist once again. So that Gabriel was associated with the mission of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now we have another one here by the name of Palmoni, presented to us as the one who is interested in Bible chronology. And he is keeping a watch over the time period associated with these events. And so you've got here Palmoni speaking. And another saint says unto this one by the name of Palmoni, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? Now you'll find that both in the printed notes and in the exposition of Daniel, that great pains are taken to point out that this word sanctuary here is the Hebrew word kodesh, and it means simply the holy. It could mean the holy people, the holy places, or the holy things. Now Brother Thomas, writing long before, of course, the time period when this time period came to an end, tied it down to what he styled the holy land and the holy city in particular. In Exposition of Daniel, and pages 28 and 29, Brother Thomas makes this statement. But the phrase that has caused the greatest difficulty is, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Theologists of the Gentiles have not perceived that the vision has no reference to the Gentiles, but as destroyers of Judah and the enemies of their king. They have therefore imagined that the sanctuary to be cleansed is the Gentile church, as if any cleansing could make the thing called the church anything but unclean. Assuming this, they have looked for the advent of Christ the year after the 2300th year, according to the common version, had expired, and have called his appearing to burn up the world and to place those whom they style the saints upon the purified earth as its sole occupants in glory, the cleansing of the sanctuary. It was a long sentence. I hope you didn't lose the subject by the time we got to the end. He's talking about the Millerites, or the Seventh-day Adventists, who want to burn up the world and then put themselves back on it after it's been cleansed. That, he says, is the cleansing of the sanctuary. Well, he says, this is as reasonable interpretation as could be expected from people who deny the restoration of the Jews and believe in world burning at the coming of Christ. But so long as men hold under such foolishness, it is impossible for them to understand the Bible or to form any rational conclusion concerning a divine predetermination respecting the issue of human affairs. But all speculations and absurdities connected with this subject are most readily extinguished by reference to the original. There we find that the words crucibleized into the fires of world-burning theories do not exist. That's interesting. I'll read that again because it's nice. There we find that the words crucibleized in the fires of world-burning theories do not exist. Then shall the sanctuary be cleansed was no part of the answer given in Daniel's hearing. The words he heard were, and he's quoted the Hebrew, the word kodesh is not sanctuary but holy, designating what is holy connected with Judah, such as the holy city, called emphatically the holy, and the holy land. Then as to this other word, nitzdak, rendered cleansed in the common version, this is not its meaning. It signifies to be vindicated from injury and violence, or to be avenged. The word for to cleanse is tahar, and is used several times in the sense of to cleanse Judea from the putrefying bodies of the slain in the prophecy of the autocrat of Russia's overthrow in the breaking of the Latino-Greek-Babylonian power. "Then the holy shall be avenged" is the only proper rendering of which the original is susceptible in this place. So you see, where it's got there, "then shall the sanctuary be cleansed," should not be translated that way, but should be translated, "then shall the holy be avenged." He goes on to point out, it must be evident to every intelligent reader that before a country in the actual possession of an enemy can be avenged for desolations current in 2400 years, he's sticking to the 2400 year period, a situation of affairs must be created favouring its deliverance. This requires time, and the time provided in the case before us is styled the time of the end. And so you see, the time of the end is the period that Daniel is going to deal with here. But I thought it was interesting to notice his comments on these words, because as you'll find in the context here, it becomes obvious to him that what is being spoken about here is that not so much the sanctuary is going to be cleansed, but that the holy city is going to be avenged, and the holy people are going to be avenged. He points out how the Ottoman power has to be thrown out. And then he says, the reply to the question, "until when," did not state the Anno Mundi, he calls it here, the year of man, as the terminus, but the development of a work. One step, however, was gained towards a solution of the question, and that was that whenever the beginning of the period might be, the avenging of the holy would not be short of 2,400 years afterwards, or 2,300 years, as the Authorised Version says. And I suggest that perhaps if you haven't done so already, you ought to read a couple of pages before that, because he deals with the events leading up to this, the fulfilment of this time period. Now this means then, when we have a look at verse 13 here, we've got a time period which is telling us, one step, however, was gained towards a solution of the question, and that was that whenever the beginning of the period might be, the avenging of the holy would not be short of 2,400 years afterwards, or 2,300 years, as the Authorised Version says. And I suggest that perhaps if you haven't done so already, you ought to read a couple of pages before that, because he deals with the events leading up to this, the fulfilment of this time period. Now this means then, when we have a look at verse 13 here, we've got a time period which is telling us that the holy, whether it be the city, the people, or the land, this is undefined, but obviously in Brother Thomas's opinion it was going to have very specific reference to the holy city, that the holy city would be avenged after 2,300 days, in verse 14. So we've got a time period here in which this little horn of the goat power, this Roman power, this desolating power, would tread down the Holy Land and the holy people. And when the nation of Israel and the city of Jerusalem would be subject to these Gentiles. Now it says, this will continue unto 2,300 days. Or as we've seen, we can interpret this as being 2,300 years. In this particular section, or shall I say the previous section, Brother Thomas points out here that the word for days is literally evening mornings. It's even as a day, of course, starts with an evening and ends with a morning. And the Jewish day does, incidentally. It starts with the evening and ends in the morning. So the term evening morning could be translated as days. But as he points out here, it has more specific relationship, of course, to the fact that there was the evening and morning sacrifice. So it speaks about the fact that the sacrifices were to be taken away, even as mentioned in verse 13. The people would be cast out of the land, the temple would be destroyed. There would be no hope of them carrying out their evening morning sacrifices. And he says this desolation would continue for 2,300 days or 2,300 years. Now it has been understood by many Christadelphian writers for quite some time, certainly going back to my knowledge at least 30 years anyway, that the start point of this particular vision was the year in which the ram and the he-goat clashed in the time of Alexander the Great. This, after all, is probably one of the most significant datings here in Daniel chapter 8. the key to the vision is this great horn of the goat doing battle with the ram. And this was in the year BC 334 and 333. And this is the time period of the battles of Granicus and Issus, when the kingdom of men transferred from Asia to Europe. This is the significance. This is why particularly this date is taken out. You see, up to this time, we haven't got a map here, so you'd have to look at the ones in front of you. Up to this time, the kingdom of men had been an Asiatic kingdom. It had been Babylonian. It had been Persian. Now we find a European power coming in, and the kingdom of men has subsequently moved its centre from Asia into Europe, allowing, of course, for the Roman power to establish itself ultimately. So this event of BC 334-333 was a very important one, because it was, as I say, this time when Alexander the Great came into Asia and overthrew the Persians. And it was the beginning of the downtreading of the children of Israel, which set the basis for the downtreading of the children of Israel by this Greco-Roman power. And so if you add 2,300 to that, it's not quite as simple as just putting them underneath each other and adding them up. You've actually got to take that one away from it, because that's a BC dating. That's like saying it was the year minus 334. And if you take that one away from there, you'll get 1966-1967 of our own particular era. And this is really very significant too, because now for the first time we see in the year 1967 the Jewish nation in control of the Holy City. And there has, I believe, been an incipient fulfilment here of this promise, in the sense that the Holy City has been partially avenged. Not completely by any means. But as Brother Thomas pointed out, if the city's going to be avenged, well, the first thing that's got to be done is that these Gentiles have got to be driven out of it. Now, it's very significant that in 1967, as a result of the Six-Day War, the Gentiles were driven out, and the Jews are now in control of the Holy City. Now, I read that section from Brother Thomas, not just to entertain you with his big words, but to show how that 100-odd years ago, he was able to interpret it this way. He, for some reason, latched onto this 2,400, which has, although he hasn't extended it through here, means that he hasn't come up with the year 1967, obviously. But the earliest notes that I've seen in our time on Daniel have this particular dating in it, and they would be the very earliest Elpis Israel class notes that were produced in this city back in about the Second World War days. So we were anticipating in something of 1966-67, and perhaps we didn't expect it quite in the fashion that it came, but certainly it is an incipient fulfilment of this 2,300-year period. Thus, dating it from the battles of Granicus and Issus, we see now the beginning of the Holy City being avenged as a result of the Gentiles being driven out of it. Has anyone got any questions or thoughts on that?
From noon to evening morning.
Yeah. Only in as much as, you see, in verse 13 it says, "How long shall be the vision concerning the daily?" And sacrifice is there in italics, which is quite right. You see, the thing that this was going to do, if you look back in the earlier verses like verse 11, that this little horn of the goat was going to magnify itself even against the prince of the host. This was the Lord Jesus Christ. So it's foretelling here the fact that Rome would be instrumental in crucifying Christ, and by it the daily sacrifice was taken away, so that when the city of Jerusalem was destroyed, there was now no opportunity for the daily sacrifice to be carried out, because there was no temple to carry it out in. And the daily sacrifice was the evening and the morning sacrifice. So that this evening-morning sacrifice became a symbol of the downtreading of Jerusalem. When they couldn't offer their sacrifice, well, the nation ceased to exist. Because it was a religious nation, and once their religious ceremonies were cut out, they couldn't exist. So we read in verse 11 that he magnified himself, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. The word for sanctuary there is the Hebrew word migdash, which means temple. It's a different word for sanctuary from sanctuary in verse 13. So it's the temple which would be destroyed. So So then comes the question, how long will it be? How long is this vision concerning the daily sacrifice? And the answer comes back, unto 2,300 evening mornings. In other words, there'll be 2,300 evening, morning, day, year periods that it shall be trodden down. There's no doubt of this, that it's certainly not completely fulfilled at the moment. There's no doubt about that at all. But the point we're making is that the sanctuary in verse 14 is not the same sanctuary as in verse 11. Just because it's the same word here doesn't mean it's the same thing, and yet it's associated with the same thing. One means specifically the temple, the other one means the holy. Now, of course, the temple was the holy place, true. But as Brother Thomas is pointing out, and that's why I went to pains to read this, you don't have to interpret verses 13 and 14 as meaning that the temple is going to be cleansed. We wouldn't expect, therefore, the temple to be cleansed in 1966-67, but certainly the holy people and their city were being avenged. And the first thing was, the Gentiles have to be driven out. So the period, this evening, morning, I'll read you one paragraph here under the heading Evening, Morning Vision. In the 26th verse it is written, the thing seen of the evening and morning which was told is true. Wherefore shut thou up the vision, for it is for many days. The vision was given principally to exhibit this great object, namely the suppression of the evening morning sacrifice until the Latino-Greek Babylonish power should be helplessly broken by the commander of the army of Israel. This is then the reason why the vision of the ram and goat is styled the thing seen of the evening and morning, or the evening morning object. When Daniel had the vision, the evening and morning sacrifice was suppressed, Jerusalem in ruins, and Judah in the province of Babylon. He was, however, fondly expecting the restoration of all these in about 16 years. But here was a new vision which taught him that a breaking up of Judah by a more formidable enemy than the Chaldeans was to occur after their restoration from the Babylonian captivity. And he goes on to speak a little bit more about what the Romans would do. So it's the idea here of the Jewish religious services being destroyed and of course being suppressed, and therefore, of course, the nation is itself ceasing to exist. Well, perhaps if we can move on into the next section, if you've got any questions on that, they can come up again later. We come now to verse 15. The section in verses 15 to 18 is where Daniel seeks the meaning of what was seen. Came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. Now, this word man here is the word Gibor or Giber, and it means a mighty man. It's somewhat similar to the term El Gibor, the mighty God, the mighty El, which we have in Isaiah 9, 6 and 7. But here was an appearance of a mighty one. In verse 16 we are told that I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand. Now you see the word Gabriel is actually a compound of this word Gibor. Ael Gibor is sort of the reverse of Gibor Ael, which is Gabriel. So it means the mighty Ael. You get this in Isaiah 9 verses 6 and 7. These verses which are descriptive of the Lord Jesus Christ. Isaiah 9 verse 6 and 7. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God. Now this term Mighty God here is El Gibor. And Gabriel is virtually the same word, just got Gibor Ael instead of El Gibor. So this term, as it is translated here, the Mighty God, is the same meaning as the meaning of the word Gabriel, this archangel here. Now, Gabriel is introduced at this stage, and he's going to turn up again in chapter 9, so we'll say a little bit more about him when we come to chapter 9, because I think this shows him to us in a more significant setting. But here is Daniel now, waiting to see and to hear the interpretation of this particular vision. And as he says in verse 17, so he came near where I stood, and when he came I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, and he touched me and set me upright. This sort of thing happens quite frequently in these visions, both in Daniel's case and in John's case. They were prostrated when they were approached by the angel, or when they saw the angel in vision. It's actually an enactment of his own death and resurrection. Once again, we're going to see this in much more detail in chapter 10, so we'll reserve any great comments on this until we come to chapter 10. But in a sense here, Daniel is enacting his own death and his own resurrection. What it is telling him is that this vision is going to be for a long time. You're going to die and you're going to be resurrected before this vision comes about. And so in order to impress upon Daniel the time period, we read that he was in a deep sleep, he was on his face, with his face toward the ground, and then he touched me and he set me upright. And he said, verse 19, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. The last end of the indignation is, of course, the time of the end, which he was speaking about in verse 17. The last end of the indignation, or the time of the end of verse 17. So he said, I'm going to let you know what's going to be in the time of the end. Now, the next two verses actually give us the lead up to the time of the end. He explains in verse 20 that the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. All right, well, we've worked that out quite a while ago, haven't we? But it's telling us now that the ram with the two horns were the kings of Media and Persia. The rough goat is the king of Greece. Well, we've worked that out too. The great horn that is between his eyes is the first king, Alexander the Great. Now, that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. Now, you remember back on verse 8, we commented on this, that the four men who stood up in the place of Alexander the Great were out of the nation, but they were not out of Alexander. Alexander had no sons. They were not Alexander's successors, family-wise, but they were successors to his position. So that whereas they were not out of Alexander, not in his power did they stand up, but they were certainly part of the Greek nation. Notice how accurate the scripture is. It doesn't leave anything to chance at all. Now, people would only examine it. They would see that it's not a matter of just some vague sort of prophecy. It's quite specific. The ones who would succeed Alexander would not be his sons, but they would be four of his generals, out of the nation, but not in his power. Now, those two verses there, three verses, 20, 21, and 22, are a lead up to the main point of the vision, because the main point of the vision is what's going to happen in the time of the end. That's what Daniel wants to know. Well, now he jumped right down over the period of time, right down to the time of the end. He says, now in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Now Rotherham, in his translation, translates the phrase transgressors as Jewish transgressors. It's speaking about the transgressors of the Jewish nation. So that in the providence of God, the power of Rome was drawn over into the land of Israel, firstly to punish Israel. They crucified their Messiah. They transgressed. Therefore, it was in the justice of God that they should be punished. So he allowed Rome to punish them. But of course, like all of these Gentile powers, they go too far. God has in mind that he would use men like Hitler to punish Israel. But he doesn't condone the extent to which Hitler will go. And therefore, of course, Hitler has to ultimately be punished. And so it is with Rome. So that in the latter time of the kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, A king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. The fierce countenance can be translated as being of warlike aspect. Understanding dark sentences, Rotherham translates it skillful in dissimulation, or it can be translated talking riddles in a harsh foreign tongue. And Brother Thomas has another translation of it, which I don't think I can pick up here quickly, but it's something very similar to that. But the idea of the talking of the riddles was... I did have it marked here, but I just can't see it now. Brother Thomas does have a translation very similar to this. So that when it says here, understanding dark sentences, it means that they talk riddles in a harsh foreign tongue. Now, if you recall, right back in Deuteronomy 28, Moses had set out there the history of the nation, right back in the early days, of course, at the time when the nation had only just been constituted a kingdom. Deuteronomy 28 speaks of the Roman invasion. Deuteronomy 28, verse 49. Yahweh shall bring a nation against thee from far, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flyeth, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, which shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favour to the young. Now this description is the same description as we've got here in Daniel chapter 8. Fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences, or speaking riddles in a harsh foreign tongue, a language which they did not understand. And it's depicting here the Roman legions with their symbol of the eagle and their language of Latin, which authorities tell us is about as far removed from Hebrew as any language could possibly be. And subsequently in Deuteronomy 28 here, we read of the siege of Jerusalem, which the Romans carried out in verse 52. He shall besiege thee in all thy gates, and so forth and so on. And it speaks about the extent... the terribleness of the siege here, in which they ate their own sons and daughters and so forth, and depicted for us the siege of Jerusalem as it was in AD 70, as Josephus bore witness to. Now Daniel here in chapter 8 and verse 23 is speaking in the first instance of this power. So he sees the development of this power, this Roman power. They would come in first of all to punish the Jewish people. But then he comes right down to the time of the end, and he sees how that both the Eastern and the Western Roman powers would oppress the Jewish people. But when we come to verse 24, we read there, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. Now when it says here that his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, what he's telling us is that whatever Rome did, it was in God's purpose that he should do it. That the Roman armies were the armies which God was sending against the nation of Israel to punish them for rejecting the Messiah. So when it says that will we not be in his own power, it is in fact the will of God that the Roman army should come. But of course, as we mentioned, they took it too far. Where it says he shall practice and shall prosper, or shall prosper and practice, the word practice in the Revised Standard Version is translated as shall succeed in what he does. So this power shall succeed in what he does. He shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. So that these Roman rulers did ultimately, of course, scatter the Jewish nation. Well, then when we come down to verse 25, we read, and through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Now this is where a person may find a little bit of difficulty in jumping from verse 24 to 25. Now, you've got to get used to doing this in books like Daniel and Revelation and so forth. Because, you see, God is following through a certain theme, he isn't worried if there's perhaps a couple of thousand years between two verses. Now, we don't see the connection between Rome and Russia. It seems to be talking of the same power right through here. And, in fact, it is. Now, the question we've got to ask is, what power is it speaking of? Well, it's speaking of the little horn of the goat. Now, the little horn of the goat was the Roman power. It's the Roman power which crucified the Lord Jesus Christ. And it's the Roman power in its eastern aspect which is the subject of this chapter. Of course, in the days of the Lord Jesus Christ, the little horn of the goat and the little horn of the fourth beast were virtually the same power, because there wasn't Eastern and Western Roman Empire in those days. So in verses 23 and 24, it is speaking of the Roman power, which is, of course, the little horn of the goat. But when we come down to verse 25, it's speaking of this same little horn of the goat in its latter-day manifestation. And that will be Russia. So that when Russia moves into Turkey, she becomes the latter-day manifestation of this ruler of the eastern section of the Roman Empire. So that when you read here that through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper, the word craft, the Hebrew word murmur, means fraud or deceit. And the word is used in places such as Jeremiah 9 verse 6 in relationship to false religion. Thus it is here that this little horn of the goat is going to cause priestcraft, if you like, false religion to prosper. He's going to do this, of course, by giving power to the Pope again. Now, I want this to be very clear that we are apparently jumping a lot of time in verses 24 and 25, but we're not changing the theme. Simply because we talk in terms of Russia in verse 25 and Rome in verse 24, this is just coincidental. They are both the little horn of the goat power. So that the little horn of the goat in its latter-day manifestation is to be the latter-day power in control of Constantinople. And this will be Russia as she moves south, according to Ezekiel 38, through Turkey and into the lands of the Middle East. So when we read here that through his policy shall he cause craft or priestcraft to prosper, and shall magnify himself in his heart, that is, he shall gain great power, and by peace shall destroy many. The word peace there is not the Hebrew word shalom. It's another word, shalvar, which means security or success. By his very security or success, he will destroy many. Rotherham translates it as by their careless security, he shall destroy many. In other words, he's saying that many people will look to this power of Russia, and when they see it uniting the whole of Europe together, and when it has got Rome under its control as well, some suggest that this is the time when the peace and safety cry goes out. They say, well, right, Russia's united the whole of Europe together. I can't imagine the Western world saying this, but everyone says, well, right, at last, we have now got a power which has united the whole of Europe together. People have been trying this for hundreds of years. And never before will they have seen a power which will have controlled so much of the area of the kingdom of men, because Russia will now have the whole of that area, with the exception, of course, of Israel and a couple of those Arab lands around there. Russia will have control over the whole lot of this. And so by its very success, many will be lulled into a false sense of security, or as Rotherham translates it, by their careless security. And some believe that this is the time when people will say, well, now we have got this peace and safety, as we read about in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 3. Whether that is the fulfillment of the peace and safety cry is perhaps open to some conjecture. But it is an interesting suggestion, because there is no doubt it is speaking of the time when Russia shall move there. And the next event which takes place is, he shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And this is, of course, when he does battle with the Lord Jesus Christ. Isn't it interesting to note that whereas Christ is called in verse 25 the Prince of Princes, in verse 11 he is styled the Prince of the Host. Notice the difference. In verse 11 he is styled the Prince of the Host. In verse 25 he is styled the Prince of Princes. Same man, but in two different aspects of his work. So that when Rome came against Jerusalem, there was the Prince of the Host, the Prince of the Host of Israel, Messiah, the Prince. And Rome crucified Israel's Messiah, the Prince of the Host. But when the latter day little horn of the goat comes down and does battle with the Lord Jesus Christ, now he fights not with the Prince of the Host so much as with the Prince of Princes. This Prince now has other princes with him. So he's doing battle with the Lord Jesus Christ in company with the saints, who are the princes. So Christ is here significantly styled the Prince of the Princes. Now just going quickly through those verses 23, 24, 25 again. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the Jewish transgressors have come to the fall, the Roman king of fierce countenance and speaking a language which they would not understand would invade Israel. In his own power he shall be mighty. Rather, his power shall be mighty, but it won't be in his own power. God has strengthened him to this work. He is going to destroy the holy people. And then nothing more is said about him. He disappears from history. He's done his work. The northern armies invade him. The Eastern Empire becomes a Byzantine Empire, and ultimately down comes Russia and becomes the little horn of the goat. Now through his policy, this is Russia's policy, he shall cause priestcraft to prosper in his hand. He'll make a coalition with the Pope. He shall magnify himself in his heart. By peace many people shall be carelessly fooled into thinking that it's true peace, and they shall ultimately be destroyed. And he shall stand up against the Prince of Princes, but he shall be broken without hand. So we'll stop there for a minute, because you may want to query how we can do just what I've done. Is there anything in those three verses particularly? Are you quite clear on how I've suddenly jumped from Rome to Russia and yet still see it as the one power? Does this sort of sound reasonable? Never sounded reasonable to me when I sat in the class and listened to it. I could never work it out.
John, I might just quickly go back to the story of the little horse of goat briefly.
Yeah. I know how I could throw the whole lot into confusion. I could say, what's the little horn of the fourth beast and its relationship to the little horn of the goat? How the little horn of the fourth beast arise?
Don't
do that. No, but isn't it? It's, if you sit down long enough, it comes clear. And then 10 days later, when someone asks you the question, you say, now, which one was that again? The origin of the little horn of the goat? Right, let's go through this step by step. What was the first beast we saw in Daniel chapter 8? The ram. The ram was Persia. Now, Persia did battle with the Greeks, and the symbol of the Greeks was the goat. The goat had a notable horn, which was Alexander. When Alexander died, that horn got chopped off, and up came four other horns, right? Those four other horns are the four successors of Alexander. Now, out of one of those horns came forth a little horn. Now, which horn did it come out of? Seleucus, that's right, the Seleucidan kingdom of the north, which was the area of Constantinople, a little power came out of there. And what power was that? What was that little horn power that came out of that area of the king of the north? Well, it was Rome. It's the eastern section of the Roman Empire. So I think many of us, every time we think of Rome, we've got to think of Italy. But you've got to bear in mind there was a stage in history when Rome was both in the east and in the west. There were virtually two Romes, both built on seven hills, both Constantinople and the city of Rome. Now, eastern Rome is the one we're talking about here. So this little power was this power that came up in Constantinople, and where they had emperors and Caesars and all sorts of things there. Now, that little horn then is the power which rules in Constantinople. And so in the days of Christ, it hadn't sort of developed properly then. It was still over in Rome. But when we come down to the time of the end, it will be the power in control of Constantinople, which is Russia. Now, this is fairly important because later on when we come to chapter 11, this little king reappears again in a section which people who don't know the truth find very difficult to understand. I've never heard a right interpretation of that outside of Christadelphia. Daniel 11, about verse 36, somewhere in about there. But we won't go into that just at the moment. So then, this little horn of the goat is the power in control of Constantinople, and it will be, in the latter days, the power of Russia. Shall I tell him? No. Verse 26. We had this out sort of at the last class, but we agreed with Brother Thomas and not with the printed notes. Historically, it came through Pergamon. Yes, we agree with that. But in the terms of Daniel, we believe that he has in mind the Seleucidan power rather than the Pergamenian power, whatever you call it. So that I think that Daniel has in mind the Seleucidan horn rather than the Pergamon horn, as Brother Thomas explains in Exposition of Daniel.
What did Pergamon
incorporate
into the...
It was, but in the terms of the four horns, I think he calls the Seleucidan horn the third horn or something like that. Not quite sure why. But we did sort of go into this last time just to point out that as far as the notes are concerned, they point out how it happened historically, but thematically, the kingdom, the horn which was the one, was this horn, the Seleucidan horn, which was the king of the north, and it was out of this king of the north power that this little horn of the goat ultimately came, out of the remnants of that one, in which case it was the Seleucidan one. It's a sort of the lead up to the latter days. It's in the latter time of their kingdom, which was the latter time of the kingdom of these Greek powers, sort of the Greco-Roman power, the latter time of that kingdom, when the transgressors would come to the full. In the latter time of their kingdom, it refers to AD 70, it doesn't refer to latter days. I'm just wondering that the their kingdom could almost be the Jewish kingdom.
Is it the kingdom of the
four? Yeah. Doesn't make any difference, it's still the same time. Yeah, that probably is speaking of that. I'm just wondering if it meant the latter time of the Jewish kingdom, because it's the Jewish transgressors that are being spoken of in the next part. And see, AD 70 was sort of the end of the Jewish commonwealth, wasn't it? Yeah, I think it is specifically speaking of the four, and it's not going to make any difference to our understanding of the context, whichever way we take that. But I just thought as I was reading it, could easily refer to the Jewish kingdom there. I'll check that out just as to what the literal translation of that would demand, whether the subject of that is the transgressors or the four. But I don't see it as the latter days, though, James, in reference to your question there, but a lead up to it. Now, the last two verses, then, we must close very shortly here. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. So you can feel somewhat at ease in realizing that there are other people who have had difficulty in understanding this. Daniel himself and others had difficulty in understanding it. But of course the blessing is to those who appreciate it and to understand it. Now, before I close on this, I want to get away from the historical aspect for a moment. I think in these studies we have sort of laboured the historical aspect because we've been trying to get the picture clear. But really, there's a tremendous exhortation here, quite independent of the historical aspect. If we can understand the background to it, of course it makes it all that much clearer. But what has God been trying to reveal to us in these two chapters? Well, he's been trying to show to us that he rules in the kingdom of men, hasn't he? And he's been giving us certain visions which can allow us to have confidence in the accuracy of the scripture. So that whether or not you've been able to follow every detail of the history, one thing will be for sure, you can at least see how accurate this is. And that God has worked these moves out. He raises up kings to perform a certain work, and when they do more than what he has asked them to do, then he punishes them as well. And so there are two great powers which have to be manifested in the latter days: Roman religious power, which is Daniel chapter 7, and the Roman political power, which will of course be the Eastern Roman section, which will be Russia. So that both of these chapters end up with the little horn of the goat and the little horn of the fourth beast being destroyed at the coming of Christ. In Daniel chapter 7, the little horn of the fourth beast is destroyed by the Son of Man. In Daniel chapter 8, the little horn of the goat is destroyed by the Prince of Princes. Notice how accurate the titles are. The Son of Man speaks of the one who has conquered the flesh in all its manifestations. It speaks of the one who... You're not going to have it here next week. You're going to get a new drive built in it. Is it yours?
Harold.
No. Harold. Where is he? we've just about said it out now, Harold. The title Son of Man was descriptive of the one who overcame the flesh, wasn't it? And we see here the religious system as being the manifestation of the flesh in all its characteristics. Now we've got the political power being destroyed by an army comprising the prince ruling over his princes. And right through the various titles and themes that are used fit in perfectly with the overall picture of the two chapters. So chapter 7 is the western section being destroyed, chapter 8 is the eastern section being destroyed. And the climax of this comes particularly in the latter section of Daniel chapter 11, where it shows the invasion of the Middle East and so forth. Now, as a little bit of a prelude to the next classes, Daniel chapter 9 now is an extremely beautiful chapter. This is going to be Daniel's prayer. We're going to go away from the prophetic aspect for a while, and we're going to consider the prayer. This is extremely exhortational and not difficult. Daniel chapter 10 is not difficult, but it's deep, but it's tremendously inspiring, I think. Daniel chapter 11, well, you'll find out what that's like when you get to that one. And then Daniel chapter 12 is an outstanding climax to the chapter, an extremely interesting and exhortational chapter. So the end, God willing, is in sight. And if you can get up with all your marking and that sort of thing, you'll find that Daniel chapter 9 is fairly plain sailing anyway. Oh, there's some notes to go out. That's these here.